drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. In the 1980s and 1990s, one of the hottest comedy acts in Australia were the Doug Anthony All-Stars, a trio from Canberra who became famous for their cutting comedy that sometimes slapped you hard right across the face. Tim Ferguson was part of the highly successful trio that went from busking on Canberra's streets, and, you know, Canberra can get quite cold, so good on them, to sell out live performances around the country and even their own TV show. But then in 1994, at the height of their fame, Tim quit the group and the All-Stars were no more. We're about to find out why he quit, the challenges life's thrown at him, and why he's back on the road touring regional and metropolitan cities with a solo show. Tim Ferguson, welcome to the drawing room.
Patricia Karvelas, this is a big moment for me. I'm a huge fan.
Well, that's very exciting. And you've also pronounced my name beautifully, so now I like you even more. Thank you so much.
Hey, no worries. Everybody else gets it wrong by calling you PK because they just don't dare do the surname.
No, that's exactly right. And look, to be fair, there's quite a few letters in my name, so, you know, obviously it's a bit hard. 1994, I remember it well. A big year. Oasis hit the music scene. Four Weddings and a Funeral was like a box office hit. Prince Charles even admitted to having an affair with Camilla Parker Bowles. Big year. Did you quit because you wanted to immerse yourself in this high-level pop culture? What was going on?
Well, it was really Camilla and Charles that made me think, you know, the comedy's being done by other people, professionals, royals. So it was time to step back.
So 1994 was the year you really noticed that your health was in decline.
Oh, I'd noticed for a long time that there were things going on since I was a teenager. There'd be things, you know, things would fall off, the wheels would fall off and then miraculously apply themselves back onto my chassis. All these wacky, strange symptoms, my eyes would go wacky, Patricia, or I'd get pins and needles that felt like actual pins and needles, not the wimpy ones that you have when you go to sleep on your arm. And they would come and they'd go. And then in London, it blew up once. And then about a year later, when we were in London again, it blew up again. And that's when I thought, man, this is a problem. And I had a young family. I'd been touring like a rock and roll star and they'd been coming with me. I just thought, you know, we've had a good decade of fun. We've made lots of TV and something's wrong with my everything. So I thought, you know, I'll come up with something else to do.
And how did you go about that process of actually diagnosing yourself for having MS? Was it actually hard?
Yeah.
Because navigating the health system is really hard, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and with MS, you've got all these different symptoms. You can have, it's up to 20 different symptoms, and some of them are quite severe that you can get. It's different for everyone, so the symptoms could just be other things, like the pins and needles, could be any number of neurological or just muscle-based problems. So they've got to eliminate all of these problems just to finally work out, ah, oh, we know what it is. Say you get the lumbar punctures, and that is, you know, it's kind of sexy in a way, but, and then finally they got an MRI of my tiny little brain, and they saw all these spots, which are little clusters of tiny, tiny scars, scleroses, and that's when they knew, hey, you know, away you go, which was okay, because at least then I realized all these different symptoms were just one thing. We could hit it with the same jackhammer.
So there was a sense of relief that you actually had an answer finally?
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I figured, oh, you know, multiple sclerosis, you can read books for that, I thought. Mm. We'll be all right. You know, we'll just get kindergartens to read books and they'll come up with a cure. I've never really worried about MS ever since. Just because worrying about the future is about as interesting and useful as worrying about the past.
Mm, it is rather useless. How has having MS shaped your career and your life? Have you ever felt like it's presented too many challenges, made it too hard to do what you want to do?
No, I mean, you just got to get past it, whatever it is. I mean, everybody's got some kind of problem apart from you. We can't all be perfect. We can't all be Patricia Karvelas.
If only I was the interview subject, you'd know the real truth. But that's a whole other podcast. But it's true. You're right. We all carry stuff, right?
Yeah. We all carry stuff. We're butting up against stuff. And, you know, so what? You know, that's life. That's what makes it interesting. So Mark Gracie and I made a movie a couple of years ago. We're just in the process of going to America and starting the process of making the next one. You know, and why would you do something so crazy? Because, well, why not? Why wouldn't you make another movie? It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And I've been on tour with the Doug Anthony All-Stars. Not emotionally easy, but worth doing. You just keep going. You know, you have to go to Canberra every once in a while. People don't understand what that's like.
You kind of have a soft spot for Canberra, don't you? You must.
Oh, yeah, I do have it. But people don't understand what happens when you go to Canberra. The local Aboriginals actually had a theory about Canberra. With all the Black Hills, the Black Mountains, it wasn't a good place to hang around for too long. And so they would stay in the region, but they wouldn't actually go specifically to Canberra, to the area around Black Mountain. The theory was that if you stayed too long, your dreams would become realities and you would go mad. Ring a bell?
It does a bit. So comedians are known for using their life experiences to write material for their shows. I mean, what else do you mind? You're back on the road doing a solo performance called Fast Life on Wheels. Tell us about the show. What are you sharing with the people that turn up?
Well, this show is about the things that life puts in front of us. And I just try to find funny ways to jolt people out of worrying about them. MS is one example. Like, I'm in a wheelchair, which immediately throws an audience off their balance. You know, they're like, oh my God, are we allowed to laugh at this guy? And then, you know, when they finally work out, or soon work out, of course you can laugh at me, then it goes downhill swiftly from there.
So how do you give them permission to laugh, well, with you, at you? It's kind of probably not the right term, right? They're laughing with you about the things that you're observing. How do you give them permission? Do you give them permission?
Yeah, I make a fool of myself and, you know, blame myself. And then people make the sensible decision, which is, oh, right, a disability isn't something we have to tiptoe around. If only because I don't like the term tiptoe, I find it excludes me. Mm. Everybody's got people who do have a clearer disability, for example, you know, they've lost their eyesight. Have their own ways of getting used to it. You know, they're over it. If you've been blind for a long time, you don't need everybody to be uncomfortable because you're blind. Because, you know, you woke up blind, you're outside blind, you're in the workplace blind. You know, there's nothing to do, but, you know, if you can, have a bit of a giggle at it. Once people work out that very common sense idea, then we can have a lot of fun. I talk about a very sad disability, it's a very strong disability, and it's quite prevalent in our society, Patricia, which is pattern baldness, male pattern baldness. And I tell people, you know, those guys deserve inclusion. And we have to raise awareness. I love the raising. We have to raise awareness about baldness. Take off the baseball caps. You know,
liberate yourselves. Let your head breathe.
That's right. And we have to treat bald men like normal people. And, you know, once you start putting in perspective with things that are more trivial, you know, people kind of get the idea, I think, that maybe we can relax about disability. And importantly, maybe we can hire people with disabilities to be in our workplace and not regard it as, you know, something we can beat our chest about. It's just good common sense.
Now, disability is more on our radars than it used to be. Is the world changing?
Well, disability is on Australia's radar because people are paying for it. The NDIS is a really expensive hobby. It's not perfect, but it's an amazing aspiration. The idea that people with disabilities can be given more control over how they adapt themselves, their lives, their homes, to deal with the disability. I was in the US recently. Nobody's talking about it.
So it's funny because we often talk about ourselves being, you know, behind, but in some ways we are kind of progressive in that sense, or we're leaders, right?
Oh, yeah. California is fascinated. Like, Finland is looking at us to see if this thing works. Normally it's always bloody Finland. You know, those communists in Finland who let their children turn up to school, get drunk, smoke cigarettes, and somehow they walk out doctors. They're looking at us at the NDIS and they're wondering, A, can we afford it, which they can, and B, how's it working? And sure, like, there are many people having trouble with the NDIS, but it's, you know, it's run by people. It's created by the government, and it will be like Medicare. People will always have a problem with Medicare. But the thing is, I'm taking the NDIS to America, and I'm going to challenge them to come up with something even remotely like it, even just a little bit like it, because in the States and in Europe, in Britain, all the developed countries, disability is still lagging way behind in terms of employment, in terms of support, in terms of recognition. People treat people with a disability as if the whole thing is disabled. So they're walking up and saying, well, you've got a flat tire, right? We'll have to smash the whole car or put it into storage. The simple fact is everybody's got something a little bit wrong with them. Dear listener, stop, have a think. See, the idiot's got a point.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Tim Ferguson is my guest in the drawing room. He's a comedian, author, performer, podcaster, film director. I'm sure I could find other titles, but, you know, we don't have all night. Part of
Handyman.
The downside of being in the public eye is that while everyone, you know, sees your successes, they also sometimes become aware of mistakes you make. And last year it became public that you sent letters to a Sydney journalist who you were upset with because I think of a review she'd written, and you signed the letters with something that you've since admitted was quite offensive. Have you kind of gone through a catharsis or a, you know, thinking about the way that this all played out both publicly and personally for you?
Oh, yeah, that happened in 1990, so nearly 30 years ago, at the height of the Doug Anthony All-Stars, where, yeah, I was sending letters off to all sorts of people, to the Prime Minister, to ministers, to a lot of politicians, all in character as, you know, the rabble Doug Anthony All-Stars. The thing is, the big difference is you can abuse an audience because there are 1,000 of them. You can shout at them and call them names, but it's very different when you do it to individuals, particularly when they're not expecting this sort of barrage. So, of course, I apologized. We all apologized publicly and also privately to Candace Sutton, who was the reviewer, who'd written something about Wendy Harmer, our mate, that we all thought was a bit, you know, was a bit down. But it was an overreaction. It was in character, but quite rightly, you know, she complained about it. And we were absolutely happy to sincerely apologise for it. Because, like I said, there's a difference between doing it to a crowd and doing it to individuals.
It's funny, though, when you talk about being in character and the way that, you know, you might behave or say things, even to an audience. Has the context changed as the years have rolled on? I mean, comedy's changed a lot. The boundaries, where we go, what we want to say has changed a lot. Have you experienced that in your own work?
No, not really. It depends what you recognise as being a boundary. The way comedy has changed is that more people are doing it. There are a lot more comedians out there, a lot more people who are trying it. People do comedy, in particular improv comedy, for therapy, to get over, you know, their fear of public speaking. You know, everybody says the world is more politically correct, but I don't see that as such a bad thing, because political correctness really is pretty common sense stuff.
Sometimes it's about having manners, isn't it?
Well, having manners, and also, you know, don't be racist, don't be sexist, don't pick on people who are, they call it punching down, people who are in a more difficult socioeconomic or physical or whatever position it might be than yourself, unless you've got a point. So you might think, oh, don't tell jokes involving the homeless, but Jasper Carrot, UK comedian, has one where he says, I've been going out with this homeless girl and it's just fantastic. Of course, we can go out on a date and then I can drop her off anywhere. You're thinking about that, Patricia. It's a funny joke because it backfires. This is what I get on the ABC. This is typical of the ABC. You don't get in trouble for laughing at that one. It backfires on the teller because he's not going to be this person's boyfriend for long. He's going to be dumped because
it does
nobody
backfire
wants,
on the teller.
Yeah, nobody wants to go out on a date and then just be dumped in the middle of the street simply because they have no home. So you can deal with any kind of issue in the same way drama does, in the same way a tragic story does. Comedy can do the same. It's just, what's your point and who really pays the price? That pause was hilarious, Patricia.
You think it's a very ABC pause, do you?
Oh, I think it's...
I was thinking about it, and quite frankly, it wasn't even your joke, so I was didn't have to. And the other thing
you need to know about me
is I barely laugh at any jokes unless they're very funny. You know, some people just laugh all the time. You have to be very funny to actually make me laugh.
Well, I'm not in that category.
Well,
God,
and I don't know, it's very hard to get there. And I'm just like, and I've also got to an age where I don't even pretend. Although I think I used to fake laugh when I was younger, but now I'm like, nah, wasn't that funny. But look, you know, I'm glad I came.
It's
I still want to turn up and support people. I don't mind if they amuse me. I like to be amused.
Right. You like to be amused.
Doesn't have to be cracking up, though, and falling off my chair, do I?
No, that's true. No, but it's a problem. I'd have that looked into.
You want
to laugh
myself
more. I mean, you're working with politicians. You want to be able to
Oh, well, they make me laugh.
Yeah. They make me laugh. I mean, they're hilarious.
I mean, I cry laugh sometimes.
Oh, I know.
You don't see that.
I laugh at them crying. It's
cry
just,
laugh.
That's just good when you
laughing.
Think... Just when you think there's nothing, you know, Barnaby will step up and it'll be, oh, fantastic. I write a thing called The Ferguson Report in the New
Daily. I was about to go there. Yeah. That's my next question. Tell me, who's the sort of, who provides the most material for you? There's quite a few people, I imagine.
Well, Barnaby's great. I mean, simply because there's so much passion in everything he does. And Barnaby's a smart guy. That's the thing that makes him different. He's a really bright guy. It's just, he's so passionate. He just doesn't think things through all the way. So he's good. Donald Trump's not so funny because all you can really do is repeat what he said and take out a couple of the adjectives. And that makes it humorous. Whereas with Barnaby, you can really have fun. Pauline Hanson, of course, from the extremities. The Greens are hilarious.
Hilarious. Yep.
You know, Bob Brown saying, oh, hey, stop with the propellers in Tasmania. Like last week, it was like the propellers are good. We need more propellers.
Now he's against them. I was really confused about that too. I thought wind farms were a good thing, but not now.
Yeah, not where Bob lives. You know, so it's as soon as people are on an extremity, they become an absolutist and then, you know, hypocrisy is inevitable. As soon as you say you're black and white, someone says, what about this little grey bird that's flying into your black and white theory? And the whole thing falls over.
It's demolished. Tim, thanks for coming in. It's been very fun talking to you.
Well, it's great. I just love to make you laugh, Patricia.
Amused. You've amused me.
Oh,
yeah. Didn't I use that word?
Yeah, Queen Victoria style.
Amused.
Very
that's
amused.
It. Thank you. Well, look, I've had a good time and hopefully our listeners have too. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Patricia.
Tim Ferguson has been my guest in The Drawing Room. You can catch Tim's show this weekend in Hobart and then later in September and October in Orange, Bathurst, Ballarat, Bendigo, Canberra and Shepparton.